Hey everybody, the Slackademics debut album, Pass Fail, is finally out. Here's a sampler of the G chords used in all 13 of the tracks on the album. There are two songs that don't have a G chord. Can you tell which ones I had to pitch shift? Okay, maybe just go listen to the album. Has she escaped the cycle of poverty?
Not yet, but she's trying. She's like clawing at it. Yeah. That's why this song's so emotional for me. Like I'm getting like emotional even talking about it because she's trying so hard.
You're much better at speaking clearly when I can see it in your eyes.
I know. I'm like,
but I'm all choked. When I do it, I lose my I start wobbling.
I can maintain.
They've heard it. No. Good job. You should sing sad songs on stage because that's the hard thing. Hey, I'm Mark.
And I'm Nicole, and this is Nevermind the Music. What are we going to talk about today, Mark?
Nicole, we are going to talk about Tracy Chapman's Fast Car.
So I remember when we were driving in your car, speed so fast it felt like I was drunk. City lights day out before us, and your arm felt nice wrapped around my shoulder, and I had a feeling that I belonged. I had a feeling I could be someone. Someone.
It's a good tempo, one of our good tempos where I can play the whole chorus and still fall under what I consider fair use.
I love time-wise. This song. This is one of my favorite songs to sing in my car.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Normally, lately, I've been starting with an amusing anecdote or something random about the song to get us there. I feel like it would be like disrespecting the song for me to do that, though. And it's weird. Why do I feel that way about this song, but not other songs we do?
Hmm.
It's like serious, but so are some of the other. I mean, we've done some serious topics.
Well, it's a sad, introspective song. Pop songs usually have like a happy ending. And this song is very true to real life. Like, you don't really have a happy ending all the time. And it's just a story of grit and resilience. And
word of the season, grit, back.
Yeah, I've been teaching a lot about it. So it's in top of mind to me.
But, I think you're right. I think, the melancholy sort of ending, maybe. I mean, this episode is coming out on Cinco de Mayo, I think.
Oh.
So we could talk about our distaste for the Second French Empire from the 19th century
want. They were the worst, right?
They were within the worst of the French Empire.
Everyone says so.
Apparently, especially for the nation of Mexico.
Huh.
So, you're a fan? You like this song?
I love this song.
This
it's
seems
awesome.
Like also your vibe. Like when I think prototypical high school Nicole, this and, you know, this sort of singer-songwriter, a little bluesy, mostly folky protest music.
And it like, this was one of the first songs that I heard that was more melancholy and true to like the human experience. And I'm into that. I want to like feel the feelings. And this song, no matter how many times you've heard it, you're tearing up. You're tearing up at this song a little bit, I think. Do you? You famously cry more than me. It's been documented, well documented. So does this song make you cry?
I cried last week. I don't think I'm going to cry, we're going to like read through. We're going to like hear almost every word of this song.
You had like a tear streaming, a single tear.
Right,
I hate to laugh at you and laugh at your vulnerability. Like that's not what this is about. But
some of you, I know you're out there. Some of you probably skip the sidetracks. Back it up.
They're the
best
ones.
Skip the sidetracks. I did cry on mic. And
you could hear the teardrop.
You could hear it. Yeah, it was awesome.
That was really lovely.
Should we talk about this song for a minute?
Like, I'm into it.
And Tracy Chapman, Cleveland native.
Okay.
Second, I think, Nevermind the Music alumnus to be from Cleveland. Do you remember the first?
I would not have any idea.
Bone Thugs and or Harmony.
Oh, Bone Thugs in Harmony.
Bone Thugs in Harmony.
In Harmony.
They are also from Cleveland.
Oh, that's
different
cool.
kind of music. This album, Tracy Chapman, it's called 1988. Oh. Nominated for Album of the Year Grammy.
Okay.
It lost to, what do you think, who should have won? Faith by George Michael.
Oh. Faith is a very good song. And George Michael in 1988, you can't really top that.
It's peak George Michael.
Yeah.
But Tracy did win Best New Artist that year. That's and great. Best Female Vocal and Best Folk Album.
It's pretty good.
So she did pretty well
did
for
herself.
Did she
have an album after this, or was this like...
Oh, definitely.
She had a long career.
So we can kind of talk about it, but like my first experience actually really with her, like I had heard this song, but I didn't... I mean, we were little when this came out. Yeah, like I didn't like pinpoint, oh, who is that? Really until that song, Give Me One Reason, came out.
So right.
That's 1995, which, I mean, I want to talk about the chart success or whatever, but this is that song. This is 1995.
Give me one reason to stay here. Yeah, let's not turn right back around.
Both songs are about like the path not taken or choosing a different road or
interesting. Yeah. That song was bewildering to me in like eighth grade or seventh grade when that came or it's 1995. Yeah. More like eighth grade stylistically, like sure. in the world of me listening to Dookie by Green Day or like Sublime 40 Ounce or like Rage Against the Machine. Okay. That song, I'm just like, what kind of music? Like I hadn't heard like blues
like
that.
Folky.
Well, I'd heard
really
blues, but I heard old blues, mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Folky blues. So that song, Tracy Chapman's technical biggest hit.
Okay.
Number three, which is surprising to me because Fast Car, I think of her signature song. You know, she has some songs like, you know, that are well-known and successful, like Talking About a Revolution or whatever, but definitely Fast Car is the one. That was only number six. The story of that song's rise. Did you look into this, the whole like Stevie Wonder floppy disk thing?
Tell me everything.
So she was sort of discovered in scare quotes by a fellow Tufts University student. She was at Tufts.
Okay.
And so was Brian Koppelman, who is now a screenwriter, but his dad owned a publishing company. And apparently this guy like went to one of her shows. She wasn't really interested. And then he like swiped one of her demos and showed it to his dad.
And then
she got a record contract at Elektra out of that. It's cool. It's
and, like,
a little like
creepy
the
gross,
consent
but,
thing is weird, but like obviously it worked out. But it goes to show like private school expensive connections, right? Like, hey, you might be in a class with someone who will swipe your music and give it to their record executive or publishing company executive dad, which is less likely to happen at the community college I teach at.
Yeah,
right?
It's not super likely at my school either. But you never know.
But so. The story of this song is like Rise, though, has to do with this 70th birthday concert for Nelson Mandela at Wembley Stadium. So she played early on. I guess she was high profile enough to get like an early spot, like before the...
Like an opener.
Kind of opener. Like maybe not even televised
on live
TV.
There's three people there and the sun's still way up.
That kind of thing.
Yeah.
But then she had to fill in for Stevie Wonder. Talk about pressure. Because Stevie Wonder, and this is very 80s Stevie Wonder... For me, he was a pioneer of like meticulously designing synthesizer sounds himself. And so he lost the floppy disk that had his synthesizer sounds on it.
Oh my gosh.
Because you'd like, this
you'd
is early
like the,
digital
yeah,
synth.
I guess.
You'd plug it into your keyboard and it would, oh, there's the sound I need for I Just Called to Say I Love You or whatever.
Right?
And he's like, I'm not going on stage. And they're like.
Because he doesn't have the floppy disk?
He doesn't have the floppy disk with, I think, his synthesizer sounds.
So she went and did the whole set?
She went and did a set and people fell in love with this song.
Wow.
And it rose, like I said, hit number six. So this song, again, like I would say her signature song, even though Give Me One Reason hit a little higher commercially. This song, 2004, Rolling Stone ranked it at number 167 on the 500 greatest songs of all time, which... To be clear, eventually they redid it in 2021 and promoted it to number 71. So I say all that, not because like, oh, that, I mean, that's cool. Number 71 out of billions is a good number, but that's the highest ranked song written solely by a female artist, at least at the time of the first draft of that. And that is crazy to me.
That's crazy.
Like, there's collaborative ones that are higher, but like, that's crazy to me.
And not even like a black female artist, like any female artist.
Any female artist, at least for at the point that
at the point that
the 2004 one, I don't know at the 2021 one if that's still true. But that, I don't know, that I found that shocking.
So let me ask you this question. Do you feel like for Tracy Chapman, she had a lot of breaks, someone stealing that demo and
passing it up. Stealing maybe, yeah.
Or like swiping it. We're saying stealing. We're heavy-handed. And then the Stevie Wonder thing. Do you think that good things happened to her or good things happened because of her talent? Do you think she made those things happen or that they happened to her?
I mean, she's really good. Like, have you heard?
Yeah, she's really good.
There's just like, especially if you watch like live what she's doing. Here's just this. I pulled this one up just for fun almost. There's a really good cover of Benny King's Stand By Me that she did on Letterman. One of the last Letterman episodes. So pretty recently.
Oh, darling, darling, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Oh, stand. Stand by me.
She's the kind of good that when it's mellow, isn't boring. Mm. When it's simple, isn't boring. When it's intimate, you're not like waiting for a crazy high note. You're not waiting for, I don't know, you can earnestly appreciate the simplicity of that as opposed to wondering when it's going to do something.
Then I was on the edge of my seat and I know that song, I'm familiar with it, but she's doing things that are surprising, but not flashy or showy, but they're just interesting.
But I say all that, I play that as like, look how good she is. I think luck is just such a massive part of this industry. I think if I was more lucky, I would be famous. Yeah. And if I was more unlucky, I would not be a college professor.
Yeah.
I think I am lucky in that I have a podcast and that I'm a college professor, but I'm also unlucky because I'm not a billionaire. Like,
not yet.
My skills are good enough that I could be either starving in the gutter or a billionaire.
Yeah.
Same with yours, right? So like, it's a weird, and you make your own luck. I don't have the kind of ruthless, I would never be a billionaire, but like there is a wide range that everybody, even somebody as talented and driven, I would think, as Tracy Chapman, is a wide range. Could she be the most famous singer-songwriter of all time? Maybe. Could she be completely unknown? I think all of that maybe could have been within possibility.
Well, the reason I ask is because what I'd like to discuss with this song is Martin Seligman's concept of learned helplessness and also this language around internal versus external locus of control. Like when you think of where your motivation is coming from, where your luck is coming from, is it coming from within you or is it coming from outside places? So that's where I'd like to go in this discussion of Fast Car, is this idea of learned helplessness. And do you make your own, do good things happen to you or do good things happen because of you? Or do bad things happen to you or do bad things happen because of you? When we talk about our motivations and our locus of control, and that's the language we use in our psych classes for sure.
That's really interesting because I actually also kind of want to talk about the lyrics today.
Yeah.
I'm going to talk a little bit about form. But fundamentally, the lyrics are what struck me. I wanted to do this song, but I had no idea what to talk about.
Mm.
And there was something that has always bugged me about this song. And that turned into part of what I love about this song that I wanted to talk about. And it actually intersects with some of the things you're talking about, which is interesting. I kind of feel like the path here is, let's talk like big picture about this song. And then I want to hear I want you to like frame it. And then I'm going to kind of dive us into the lyrics in a more specific way, maybe.
Okay, great.
And then we can come back. But before we do that, copyright watch 2026.
Okay.
Can we do plagiarism update?
Yeah, of course.
All right, because...
plagiarism update.
Yeah.
Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba.
There's always something. This one's pretty recent. She sued Nicki Minaj in 2018 for a song she did, Sorry, with Nas. So this song, because of the dispute, was actually completely left unreleased. Like, you can find it online, but I don't think it's official.
Oh, the Nicki Minaj song.
Yeah, so it's...
Do we have it?
Definitely. So, but it's one of those things where it's you can hear it, but I think it's not commercially... Like, you gotta go on SoundCloud or YouTube, like, it's not on streaming or whatever. Because they, I guess, never just decided it wasn't worth it. So, apparently, she was asked to approve a sample of her song, Baby, Can I Hold You? This song was a minor hit from that debut album.
Sorry, it's all that you can say. Years gone.
Like, is Tracy Chapman okay?
It's just, it's kind of a sad song. That's not like a social commentary song. It's more of a like, sad love song, kind of.
Pretty sad, yeah.
But so there's a cover version of this song. And cover versions are not necessarily, they don't need to be cleared in the same way. You just have to pay the songwriting royalties, right? So this is an artist named Shelly Thunder. This song is called Sorry, not Baby Can I Hold You, but it is a reggae adjacent cover of this song, Baby Can I Hold You.
Sorry is all that you can say. Years gone by and still the words don't come easily. Life's sorry, life's sorry.
And that gets sampled.
Okay.
You're looking at me funny. You're not.
Well, I'm just like, I don't like that.
You don't like the dance hall-y kind of.
It felt like a video game soundtrack with lyrics on top of it.
You prefer the original?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
So
here's Nicki Minaj's song, which is not called Baby Can I Hold You, but called Sorry, which has a sample of that.
Sure.
Sorry is all that you can say. Years gone by.
That's not even a sample. She's just redoing it.
Well, I think it's sampling the bow, 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 the backing.
Oh, okay.
It's like redoing the vocal, redoing the melody,
with the same
sampling
treatment,
the instrumentation of the Shelly Thunder version, but not just branded as a cover, right?
Right.
Which means it doesn't just list Tracy Chapman as the artist, right? It's a sample that they tried to clear and couldn't clear.
Through Tracy Chapman. What about the intermediary? What about the
Shelly Thunder? Did they clear that? I don't think there's a problem there. But
because
I don't
know that. Where I see more of a problem.
Why?
Because it's so similar to the Thunder version of the song. And
but they probably cleared that sample with Shelly Thunder.
Oh. Did Shelly Thunder ever clear it with Tracy Chapman?
You don't have to necessarily.
Because it's a cover.
Because you're
tricky.
You're just paying all the songwriting royalties to.
And did they?
I believe so, yeah.
Okay.
I don't know.
So at that point,
I never heard anything about her suing Shelly Thunder.
How interesting. But at that point, wouldn't it be a Shelly Thunder problem, not a Tracy Chapman problem for Nicki Minaj?
If
Shelly Thunder owns it because Tracy Chapman, they're paying royalties to Tracy Chapman, wouldn't Shelly Thunder have to just approve Nicki Minaj using it?
She probably did approve Nicki Minaj using it.
So
the
I feel like it's free and clear, but they didn't even like escalate it.
But,
Shelved the whole project.
Okay. Everybody pause and re-listen to the entire
copyright episode.
Down Under.
Yeah, okay.
Right? Listen to the network episode. No. So Shelly Thunder is doing a cover.
Mm-hmm.
Shelly Thunder is paying 100% of the songwriting royalties, which is a piece of the pie when something goes on the radio or gets purchased, right? A piece of the pie that is automatically paid to Tracy Chapman or whoever is the listed songwriter. This is a compulsory license, and it's called a mechanical license. You just like it automatically kind of happens. You don't even really negotiate it. There's a certain rate that like a cut that person gets and et cetera. That's just like standard, right? People get permission to make things easier, but you kind of could just go rogue as long as you're crediting correctly and paying royalties, right? So Nicki Minaj then is sampling that song. There's two types of ownership to Shelly Thunder's track, Sorry. There's the songwriting authorship, which is Tracy's, and what's called the master, which is the owning
Thunder's.
Of the actual record itself, the recording, which either Shelly Thunder owns or in some cases the
her
record company owns, right? So whoever that is, whether it's Shelly or whoever her label was, they approved the use of the sample and some amount of money was paid to them for that. But the song is still composed by Tracy Chapman.
Right.
And so I guess the full songwriting royalty was not given to Chapman or something like that is the deal. Because they didn't treat it just as Nicki Minaj or Nicki Minaj's people didn't just treat it as we are doing a cover of Baby Can I Hold You that also is a sample of this other cover of Baby Can I Hold You in the same way that Sublime doing Time is mm-hmm. not only a sort of cover or interpolation of the original song from the opera Porgy and Bess, Summertime, but also has a sample of the vibraphone part from the jazz version.
Right.
I don't remember which artist. Like, that's a lot of paths. You still have to acknowledge the songwriter. And I think Tracy Chapman was sort of not acknowledged as the songwriter. And she, in any case, like, tried to stop it. They ignored that.
Oh.
And then she sued. And the judge said the some of it, there were two counts. The first count was okay under fair use.
Yeah.
And I don't remember exactly when I was looking this up which piece that is, but they settled on the second. So Nicki Minaj paid her $450,000.
Not nothing.
And then the song didn't even really fully come out as a single or anything.
Well, it's a bad song.
I think I like, okay, whatever, yeah.
I like the Nicki Minaj version more than the Thunder version. Yeah. But not as much as the Tracy Chapman
version. It's just convoluted because the first one's more okay because it's a cover. The people didn't come to hear more about copyright stuff.
I know, like it was just a whole other
I've got this as like three lines in my notes and we're talking about it for like 10 minutes.
I had too many questions.
Yeah, no,
I'm a curious bird.
People write in if you want copyright and plagiarism watch to stop being a
it'll keep coming up.
Because I'm going to keep bringing it up. So, like I mentioned, I kind of want to talk about the lyrics, which imagine that. Let me, I guess, just frame my approach here, and then I want to pass it off to you, yeah?
Yeah.
I've always thought this was a good song. That guitar riff is really cool. The chorus is catchy. It's got a cool bit when the drums come in. The beat, like, turns on, sort of. But honestly, I've kind of always also thought that this song was boring.
Oh.
And this is the framing.
Hot take.
Yeah, hot take. Why? That really cool riff. Can I highlight your excellent tonal memory?
Mm-hmm.
Because you started to hum the do-do-do-do.
And it was right on
and
right
you were
on
in
head.
The right key
yeah.
right before. So everybody...
I can like,
I did not auto-tune Nicole
no,
there.
No, I can like hear it in
hear
my
it in
head before
you,
it comes on.
You know why? Because you hear it 47.5 times in the song.
0.5, you counted.
Because it ends just a ba-da-da-bum, which I counted as a half. Math people, you can find the real math there. 47 and a half times, unless I miscounted. Mm-hmm. I did mess up the first time I was counting and have to restart,
oh
which
my
was
gosh,
very painful. I was
maniac.
Like 30, 30 riffs
people
through.
Are concerned about it.
That's right.
People would have...
Okay. So this actually hit me hard because the ensemble that I direct at my college, we did this one semester and I transcribed the song and I'm like, oh my God, this is too much because there's four verses before you even get the first chorus. There's seven verses in this song.
Wow.
I've always liked this song, but also been like, oh my God, this is a little boring.
I guess I love a verse. I think that's what
I think
it
you
is.
Do. You're a folk person, and that's kind of where I want to go with this. But then, because I never heard this whole record, and I want to talk about the song. I don't know what to talk about.
Mm.
I listen to the whole record, and I get it. And the repetition, the tediousness of hearing verse, is a feature, not a bug. So I knew this song was social commentary. You know, like sort of like talking about a revolution on that album, stuff like that. But it's only when reminding myself of some of the other songs on this record that I like finally got it in terms of what she's really doing. So here's a few samples. This is Behind the Wall.
Last night I heard the screaming, then a silence that chilled my soul. Prayed that I was dreaming when I saw the ambulance in the road. And the policeman said, I'm here to keep the peace. Will the crowd disperse? I think we all could use some sleep.
Yeah. That's beautiful.
Yeah. And then...
It's this, poetry.
Yeah. This tune, For My Lover.
2 weeks in a Virginia jail. For my lover, for my lover. $20,000 bill. For my lover, for my lover. Every day I'm psychoanalyzed. For my lover, for my lover. Show me up and I tell him lies. For my lover, for my
in connecting with this album, I don't think it's quite a concept album, but the sort of story of the album, I'm drawn to the storytelling using the repetition and using the sort of controlling how often we get that chorus and what exactly that chorus means and how negative and positive each verse is as being a thing that helps the song tell its story and not a thing that makes kind of a music first person like me get bored.
Yeah.
That actually, if I'm listening to the music in a different way that I know folks like you listen to, which is more lyrics first, these are not bad things. This actually makes this song powerful. So that's kind of where I want to go.
Awesome.
So I kind of want to hear, because I'm going to go through and kind of say, okay, well, this verse, I think, does this to the story, and then the plot progresses, and then we back up. But why don't you kind of go where you want to go, and we'll come back to that.
Well, I'm really interested in you noting the repetition and kind of replaying things over and over, because that really does connect to this idea of learned helplessness. Have you ever heard that expression before?
Learned helplessness is like a negative thing that happens where you, is it like you don't even try, you allow bad things to happen to you because not of a Pavlovian response, but you've been almost trained to not defend yourself or not help yourself, something like that?
Something like that. You're like circling around it. So
circling the drain.
Circling, well, kind of, appropriate to this learned helplessness model here. So we talked about positive psychology before on this podcast, I think, especially in our Hope Punk episode.
Yeah, right, right.
And I may have mentioned a guy named Martin Seligman. And yes, our guest was saying that she went to UPenn and that's where Martin Seligman teaches. He teaches about positive psychology and happiness and growth mindset and hope. His research started in this idea of learned helplessness in the 1960s and 1970s. And he developed this theory that suggests that individuals, when they experience situations where their actions don't change the outcome, they stop even trying to change the situation. When they're trying to, you know, change their circumstances or change their life and they realize that nothing ever works, they tend to just stop trying.
Yeah.
And Seligman coined this as learned helplessness. They learn and are conditioned over time to just not try anymore because what's the point?
Right? Yeah.
Later on, a lot of folks connect this idea of learned helplessness to depression, that, you know, this feeling of hopelessness, this, you know, what I do doesn't matter. I can't change the outcome. It's like this repetitive rumination about like, why even bother? And that's how we make the connection between this learned helplessness model and depression. And then later how like maybe positive psychology can help us overcome depression if we shift our mindset from more of a fixed mindset to a growth mindset. And I'm sure you've heard those expressions before, just being in education, growth and fixed mindset.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And I think of myself as a growth mindset person in general.
We're both growth mindset people. I think most teachers are.
Right.
You'd be a bad teacher if you
subvert,
were.
It would subvert. You know, and I have to say, like, I know this maybe is a slightly different thing, but this idea of the sort of why should I bother? I see that a lot with music teaching, especially if I'm dealing with a class that is not musicians necessarily, like a general education group or something, where people are convinced that they can't learn the thing and then they just don't even engage really. And this, I think, this kind of thing, you probably could follow somebody back in second grade. They struggled to learn multiplication or whatever. And so fast forward to junior year of high school and they're not even bothering on the algebra because they're like, they've convinced themselves that trying hard didn't work. So don't even bother, right?
Right. And that's a condition of learned helplessness. And also, we can apply some sociological terms to that example of things like labeling theory. Labeling theory says that if you start labeling yourself or labeling other people a certain way, they're going to start acting in that way. Like if you label yourself as someone that's bad at math, you're going to get to that algebra 2 in high school and be like, I'm not even going to bother. I'm bad at math. It becomes part of your self-concept. Yeah. Or if you label yourself as a good student and you get a C, you might be crushed because it's so rooted in your self-concept, like, I am a good student. Or when we start telling people that you're hopeless, you'll never amount to anything, you'll never escape the situation you were born into, they might start thinking, why even bother trying?
Right.
Because everyone else tried, no one could get out of it. We have an external locus of control anyway as humans, so why even bother trying? So that goes back to my previous comment about like internal and external locus of control. Like when you think of the circumstances that are in your life, are they there because of you or do they happen to you? Right.
Can you talk to me about this word locus?
Locus.
What is that feels like it's doing a lot in that. And I don't quite even know what you mean when you say that.
So
like a locus of control is a sense of control.
Yeah. So the definition of the term locus is a particular position, point or place. That's how we're using this.
Like, okay. Yeah.
In math, I'm looking at the definition.
Is it plural? Is loci?
Loci, probably. L-O-C-I.
Okay.
It's L-O-C-U-S, not locust. Like
not like the bug, yeah.
No.
Unfortunately, that'd be pretty cool, though.
The locust of control. They're coming in a swarm to like make you turn you into your best self. That would actually would be an awesome like film or something. That would be my superhero.
And it turns out it's actually fairies or something.
If I was like a mutant superhero, I'd be the locust of control. $1 million idea.
Locust. People write in and talk to us about locusts because I feel like living. I've never lived in the Midwest where I think that's like literally still happens.
Is
in
it?
Some
I thought it was just like a Bible Armageddon thing.
Real stuff happens in the Bible, though. Like, no, I think locusts are still a thing where swarms of grasshoppers will come and demolish a crop. Or cicadas and stuff. It's kind of nuts.
And if a bunch of locusts destroy your crop, does that reference an internal or external locus of control?
I think it's external unless it's divine punishment for things you have done.
Well, this is an interesting philosophical argument.
So locus of control is your positioning relative to having or not having the control.
Yeah, your positioning relative to your circumstances or like how the circumstances come up. Like we both, I think, feel like we have internal, or I know for me, I feel like I have an internal locus of control. I feel like good things happen because of me, because I'm talented and smart and advocate for myself, right?
And there's also the fundamental attribution error there, right? Which we also talked about recently,
yeah,
right?
It's more not necessarily a
fundamental. Which means you are in charge of your good things and other bad things are because of people's. Oh, no, it's the opposite.
That's not the fundamental attribution.
Is the opposite, right? Yes. Where like bad things or like you're late because. Should I cut it out or is this? Yeah, I'll
no,
cut
it's
it
great because I can prove I can like teach you.
Yeah, it's good.
A lot of people get this mixed up. The fundamental attribution error is assuming that if you do bad things, you're a bad person. Or if you do good you're a good person.
This person cut the line in traffic because
so
they're just
an
jerk,
asshole.
Not because they're
in
they're
a situation,
pregnant,
right?
Person in the backseat. Yeah.
The fundamental attribution error is ignoring the fact that we have internal motivations as individuals.
Right.
And the locus of control is all about identifying those internal motivations. Okay. What if you have an internal locus of control? Most likely, what you have is called a self-serving bias.
Sure.
Example, right? We're teachers. People in our classes get good and bad grades.
Yes.
Yes. When students get a good grade, they often say, I got an A.
As opposed to Professor Vatcher gave me an F?
Yes.
Yes.
And that's an example.
I'm extremely careful when I write emails to people about their grades.
Yes.
To say like,
You earned
or you received,
yes.
Whether it's good or bad.
Same.
Because I don't want the paper trail of like, it proves a bias if I say I gave you an F.
It does.
I am saying that it was a thing that I bequeathed onto you, right?
Mm-hmm. And that's why it becomes problematic in our field when professors grade intuitively.
Right.
You and I...
got to have a rubric.
There's
yeah.
no way you yeah. and I are doing that. We're rubric people, but not everyone is. I'm sure in music, you have to work with faculty that grade intuitively, grade based on feeling. Not cool. Right?
People that I've worked with for years, literally, they'll like call me up being like,
what's a rubric?
Dear chair, right? Because that's what I am. I'm the department chair, right? And so I'm not their boss, but I'm like first among equals. They'll be like, God, there's this student that da 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 da. And I'm trying to, should I fail that student? I'm like, what does the syllabus say? You didn't say attendance was mandatory in your syllabus? Then no, you can't fail them.
There's policy.
If you said, if you don't submit your jury videos on time, you get an F, well, then you should give them an F. But if you can't like make that up, like, because musicians, look, some of us that are teaching music theory or whatever, like cut our teeth as grad students in a classroom, you know, TAing. If you were like a opera singer major, your TA position was like coach the voice majors in their opera studio. Like you weren't doing a syllabus. You weren't doing. And so some people, it's just, and it's not a negative or a bad thing. It's just, it's not natural for them to be systematizing, like,
yeah, but we taking need this, to.
But you have to if you're going to fail somebody, yes, right?
And that really being very careful about that language in our field is really showing an understanding, whether you believe know it or not, of these concepts, of the concepts that if students do poorly, it's on them. If students do well, it's on them. They have internal locus of control. You don't do it to them, you know?
Right. So bringing this back to this, this song. So you're talking about this locus of control as it relates specifically to learned helplessness.
Yes.
So somebody learned helplessness chiefly is associated with an external locus of control.
Yeah, it was about, it came up in early experiments that rats were exposed to stress and they were given no chance to leave that stressful environment. And then after a while, they exposed the rats to the same stress and like opened the door to the cage. And the rats still wouldn't leave because they had been learned, they had been taught that it doesn't matter.
Is this like predating modern ethical?
Yes, this is 1960s.
Not okay what they were doing.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's probably still, they can probably still do stuff like that if they have.
To rats, yeah.
But when we think of this song, it talks about like trying to change your circumstances, right? Trying to like leave the cage. The door's open, we're trying to leave, but they still can't like escape the patterns.
Effort for trying, though?
Effort so for
does
trying.
The, does the try, and I think the try and whether it's successful is a big part of our conversation today.
Yeah.
Does the try tell us this is not learned helplessness?
The try tells us it's not learned helplessness. The try the try tells us that they want to believe that they have an internal locus of control, but things are getting in the way. They can't overcome.
Learned helplessness is when you become convinced there is only an external locus.
Yeah, that's
and
good.
That's not true in this song.
It's not true in this song.
At least.
It's interesting to like think of these concepts when we listen to the song because you want them to succeed. You want them to win and they don't.
They don't. And I think that the 47 and a half times we hear the riff is possibly our proof that they aren't going to succeed.
No, and they're like trapped in this cycle, right? And this song is talking about these generational cycles.
Cycles of poverty.
Poverty and abuse and like toxic relationships almost and trying to overcome, trying to pull yourself out of it, but can keep getting sucked back in.
And I should mention, according to what I found, like this is not directly autobiographical, but it's based on things she observed growing up in Cleveland.
It's not entirely
autobiographical. The 70s or whatever, that she would see this pattern that people couldn't escape. And they're very much that fast car imagery, literal escape. They're trying to actually get out, but yet that follows them. It's like a, you know, a haunting movie or whatever, where like the ghost follows you to the next house, right?
Yeah.
So let me talk through some of the words and let's listen to some of the words,
but
we can circle back. Why don't we like check in on this with each verse? Like where is this in the story and where is this with the...
And it's really interesting too, because when I said that Martin Seligman really built his career around these areas of positive psychology and learned helplessness doesn't feel like positive psychology that much. It's really interesting to watch the arc of his career and his mentality change around like how we can explain this human condition and how we can reframe it. And I think that's going to be some cool connections to make.
I wonder, I mean, we've been talking about like in recent recordings, like, okay, well, I'm trying to think of a song concept we haven't done yet. Oh, let's do form. And you're like, oh, well, have we talked about this psych concept? I feel like maybe we can come back to, this is a great example of the locus of control that we can follow through lyrics, but we might find a song in the future that is a example of learned helplessness that's actually taking hold, as opposed to this song, which I think they're demonstrating an ability to not suffer from learned helplessness, even though maybe they should, because it doesn't matter what
they
do.
So maybe when we talk about this song, we'll talk about the internal, external locus of control. But now our listeners have that primer on learned helplessness for later. So
when we find a really sad song.
Well, there's
so
many sad songs.
Okay, so let's start off and let's follow this thread, but also just what is the main emotion and story plot sort of moment of each section of the song? So again, good tempo, because we get to hear basically a full section here. This is the first verse of the song.
You get a fast car. I want a ticket to anywhere. Maybe we make a deal. Maybe together we can get somewhere. Any place is better. Starting from zero, got nothing to lose. Maybe we'll make something. Me, myself, I got nothing to prove.
What do we get from that? What's the theme?
Well, we're setting up this idea that we're not doing anything here. Let's get out. Let's leave.
This is like the want verse, right? This is what they want. And, you know, maybe it's a potential energy, right? It's all upside. What can we do?
Well, in, I'm a drama kid. And in drama, they always said to you, like, when before you go on stage, think to yourself, who am I? Where am I going? What do I want? And I think that that's a great way to set the stage for any story, to like think of that intention.
That's funny. I know you said drama and not musicals, but don't the stereotype in musicals is there's the want song, like a Disney princess want song, the like part of her world or whatever. You don't just frame who the character is, but you frame who the character is by saying what do they desire.
And that like sets up the narrative arc. And that's what this first verse is doing, is starting to lay the foundation of who these characters are, who this character is, and what she wants.
No sign of learned helplessness. Internal locus of control.
Internal locus of control. Huge testament to growth mindset. Yeah. Like, we got nothing to lose. Maybe it'll work out, but we got nothing to prove. Let's just try. Shows motivation. Totally. Intrinsic motivation.
Verse number two.
You got a fast car. I got a plan to get us out of here. Been working at the convenience store. Managed to save just a little bit of money. Won't have to drive too far. Cross the border and into the city. You and I can both get jobs and finally see what it means to be living.
What do you got?
Yeah, same here. It's like we're motivated and like we can overcome these circumstances and it wouldn't even be hard to do. Like the cage is open. Let's leave.
Yeah. It's the looking more specifically at the circumstances in this one that makes me feel like if the first one is like, what do we want? This is more the how. Do you have the lyrics open?
Yeah.
What are some of the words there again?
I've been working at a convenience store, managed to save some money. We'll cross the border and get into the city. We'll get jobs. It won't even be hard.
It's got specifics. This is like, let's make a plan.
And there's intention.
And it's optimistic.
It's optimistic and it's accessible. Like, we're just going to drive and we're going to get some jobs.
So again, more evidence of an internal locus, right? Grabbing that power.
Absolutely.
Now, we've had two verses. We don't yet have a chorus, which is very odd for a pop song, less odd for a folk song.
This isn't really a pop song.
But it kind of is, but it kind of isn't, right?
Yeah.
We can talk a little bit about that, but later, like I'm going to play a Dylan song that has 17 verses. Mm. So the folk music tradition, and Dylan is also folk pop music in the sense that it's not true folk music. It's not like a amateur 19th century like America. It's like a professional songwriter.
I can love Bob Dylan,
but
you could probably guess that.
just a little telegraphed, I think. But there is this tradition in the folk world of having a lot of verses, right? The verse chorus form, we talked about this with Boys to Men, comes out of country music, which is kind of like a pop music version of folk music from the early 20th century, right? So, okay, we have another verse, still no chorus, verse three.
See, my old man's got a problem. Yeah, but the bottle, that's the way it is. He says, body's too old for working. His body's too young to look like his. My mama went off and left him. She wanted more from life than he could give. I said, somebody's got to take care of him. So I quit school, and that's what I did.
This is where the song gets, like, less hopeful and more sad to me and more real.
It's dark.
Like, she had to surrender her dreams to take care of her dad because her mom couldn't deal with it. Her mom like took the out and it wasn't really developmentally appropriate for Tracy Chapman or whoever this character is. I'm labeling this Tracy Chapman, but it could be anybody.
Quit school. So she's either high school or young or college or something.
Kind of an off time event to have to take care of
a parent when you're 20 or whatever.
When you're 18, 20.
Yeah. This one is darker, whereas the first two are very optimistic. But to me, this is also explanatory.
It does.
So if the first one is like, what do we want? How are we going to get it? Is the second one. This is why.
Why? Because I never got the chance to spread my wings. And now I do. But it's the same thing her mom did. Her mom just took off and left.
Yeah.
Because she saw that maybe the cage wasn't open,
but
she's
gonna
she's going to bust through it.
So I want to, again, kind of what I was drawn to talk about this is like the fact that it has seven verses, which I used to view as kind of a negative. Think about the fact, now we haven't reached the chorus yet, but we had this abrupt turn in tone before we've had the chorus. And the chorus, as we'll see, has a different flavor. And so what does that do to the story? The fact that we haven't even reached the like, ta-da, here's what this is saying. We haven't even reached that yet, but we have this back where you're supposed to like see not only the reason why, but also where this is ultimately going. Right?
And there's like a whole, I'm looking at the lyrics and I'm now learning that I'm very good at annotating form.
Okay.
And I'm seeing like the I'm calling it a pre-chorus coming up next. That's kind of setting the intention of for what the chorus is going to tell
us. I would call this next thing just a fourth verse.
Okay.
But it is shorter. But musically, it's just a shorter verse. It's half as long.
Mm.
So I could see why you'd say pre-chorus. Like structurally, it's different. But musically, it's sort of just a mini verse.
All right.
So let's listen and see what it's
whatever.
Doing.
You got a fast car. Is it fast enough so we can fly away? You got to make a decision. Leave tonight or live and die this way.
Also, notably, not to rain on your parade too much, but a pre-chorus usually builds to a thing.
Yeah, this doesn't.
Goes right back to meow, 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 meow.
And that's interesting because you want it to build. And even the lyrics are adding urgency, like leave tonight or live and die this way. It's a very all or nothing mentality, just like what we call a cognitive distortion.
So this verse I think of as the decision.
Yeah.
Right. And she literally says, we got to make a decision or something like this. This is where we go from what do we want? How do we want it? Why? Which is the first three to we're deciding we're going to actually do this. So there's like a consideration in the brain and then a decisive action. But then things change a little bit and we get our chorus.
So I remember when we were driving, driving in your car, speed so fast, I felt like I was drunk. City lights day out before us and your arm felt nice wrapped around my shoulder and I had a feeling that I belong. I had a feeling I could be someone, be someone, be someone.
Man, this song gets me every time. I've heard this song a million times.
So
and like every time I'm just like, it's so relatable. And it's so relatable for me. And this isn't my lived experience. I mean, I have a blessed life. And this feeling that like there's always more out there is just haunting. And it's expressed so lovely in just the lyrics and the way the treatment of them. It's just like it's so beautiful. And you just want her to win. You just want them to win so bad, you know?
Totally. What I want to highlight here also, though, is this is like written differently, like structured poetically, so to speak.
Mm.
This is in past tense.
Yeah.
All of the rest of the verses, you got a fast car. You're almost in a conversation discussing what's about to happen. It's more present tense and talking about the future, right? We're going to do this. It's either present or future tense. And now, do you remember when we were driving in your car?
Right.
Speed so fast, felt like I was drunk. It's all reminiscent here. It's interesting because even though it's hyper specific, it's describing a very specific moment, right? Driving in a car with someone's arm around you. It's really much more about the emotion, not about the story, but about the emotional moment.
And like chasing that feeling, you know, that like one feeling of that one moment that you felt free. And like, maybe we can get back there. I'm going to cry. I think I'm going to cry, like actually shed a tear.
Well, I'm gonna milk it.
And you can make
fun
of me.
I'm gonna milk it
because
we gotta get it. I gotta get back. And we're gonna title the episode Nicole Cries.
Nicole finally shows human emotion.
And Mark laughs.
Mark laughs.
So I hear this as pretty positive, energizing. This section.
I still feel so sad to me. I don't know why.
But it's because of what happened in the arc before.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what my point is here. That we just had that, to me, that third verse is the really important piece because it's the negative. Why are we doing this? The cycle of poverty with your father you have to take care of. And the past tense of the chorus, after we've had that emotional journey of the sort of herky jerky of, oh, everything's good. Oh, wait, no, things aren't good. Okay, let's actually do this thing. And then there's this past tense. Do you remember this? Makes you wonder like, wait, is this a cycle? Yeah. Where are we in the story right now? Is it unclear if she still feels this way? Do you remember back when we were happy?
Right.
Is not a good way to affirm the listener that you are still happy.
Well, no. And especially if you were happy, you wouldn't be thinking about making this major drastic change that had such high stakes to it. Like leave tonight or live and die this way.
Well, fast forwarding to the end. Right. So there's something about if we had verse one, verse two, this is what I want. This is how we're going to do it. Then this chorus. Mm-hmm. You're like, this is a story about redemption. This is a story about freeing yourself.
Yeah.
The fact that we have this sort of way too long, 2 minutes or whatever, of four verses before we get that first chorus tells us that this is a story about the cycles of poverty. We should not be hearing this as fully happy. This is melancholy. And there's something unsettled about this chorus because it's past tense and we've already seen the sort of dark aspects to this story. Yes. What do you think?
Yeah. I agree with you. It's foreshadowing.
Because the pop song version of this, the fully pop song version of this, this would be the second chorus.
Okay.
We would have already have heard that first chorus, which two verses ago, which would have felt just empowered.
And then
by the time we're at this chorus, we're programmed, let's go. Whereas right. Now I'm forced to really think,
should we go?
Should we?
Like, is this actually pointless? Is it going to work?
The weird thing is, we only have three more verses at this point.
Yeah.
So the song has told us a lot of it. So let's
see where
we go.
There's a lot of exposition in this song.
It's very much set up. The act mm-hmm. one, I think of this song, if we think of it like a story,
yeah,
we just finished chapter one.
Mm-hmm.
Act one of this play is longer than act two and three.
Yeah.
Verse five. What are we getting here?
You got a fast car. We go cruise and entertain ourselves. Still ain't got a job. Now work in the market as a checkout girl. I know things will get better. You'll find work and I'll get promoted. We'll move out of the shelter. Buy a bigger house and live in the suburb.
So we're seeing like still, she's maintaining her growth mindset.
Yep.
Right?
Things are tough. They're living in a shelter, but yeah, they're going to get out.
But she's going to get out and
yep.
She has hope and... You're starting to feel like maybe her partnership isn't matched in that mindset.
Yeah.
That maybe there's some hopelessness creeping in to a really highly motivated plan.
At least one of them.
At least one of them. Yeah. And also, I'm reading it as autobiographical, but I'm reminding myself that it's not. It's just telling a story of a character. And I'm affirmed in that. I'm sure at some point you're going to bring up the Luke Combs version, like, more recent yep. cover of the song. In that version, he doesn't change the lyric here. The lyric is, and I work in the market as a checkout girl.
Yep.
He sings it as that. Like he sings, I work in the market as a checkout girl. And I think that that's a really interesting choice. He could have.
Yeah.
Like he could have changed it to be autobiographical, but I think he deliberately kept it as it's written to speak to more of like a storytelling, like an objective storytelling.
So, I mean... We're right in the middle of the verses here, but let's talk about the Luke Combs version now. So there's actually a lot of covers of this song, and Luke Combs is merely the most famous.
Yeah.
I just wanted to call out one. Tell me what you think. This is the Swedish dance artist Tob Talk.
Okay. I want a ticket to anywhere. Maybe we can make it. Maybe together we can get somewhere. Any place is better. Starting from zero, got nothing to lose. Maybe we'll make something.
What do you think?
What do you think I think of that?
I think you hate it. I like it.
I like it. Like it's there's a time and place that if I heard that song, I'd be like, oh my God, it's a Swedish cover of this song.
But you hate that
song.
It exists.
It's such the antithesis of what this song is about. Right. Like this song, I want to feel sad when I listen to music and that is not doing it to me.
So Luke Combs, number one single cover version from a couple years ago.
You got a fast car. We go cruising, entertain ourselves. Still ain't got a job. So I work in the market as a checkout girl. I know things will get better. You'll find work and I'll get promoted. And we'll move out of the shelter. Buy a bigger house, live in the suburb.
So the thing about that checkout girl line, he is also playing it as a story he's telling about a character. Right.
Yeah.
Not an autobiographical thing. And when we think of like, oh, white country musician takes a black song, like he's doing what he should be doing, which is it's a story he's telling. He's not making it about him.
Yeah.
And I think it's a very straightforward cover. Like he basically just does the song the way she does it.
Love that.
And we could years of evidence like decry like, oh, a white artist becomes more successful. The fact is she got a lot of money from mm-hmm. him doing that cover. He honored her in so doing that. It yeah. seemed like, so like, she was the first Black person ever to win a Country Music Association Award for Song of the Year because of that song 30 years or whatever later yeah. than she wrote
and
it.
She performed live with him a version, yeah. I think, on the Grammys or something. And it was awesome.
And that's the thing. Yeah. So, awesome. 2024 Grammy Awards. The thing that kind of is a trip about that performance is they trade verses.
Mm.
And so it almost reframes the story where you could consider it as two people
yeah.
doing the two sides of the story, except that he doesn't change the word. And right. I don't remember exactly which verses he gets there, but it almost suggests, do we have a different perspective being offered as like a two-part narrative? But then the way that he treats the song as just, no, we're just telling a story about a woman and her partner, subverts that. Like there's an mm. opportunity to, oh, it's a duet where they're talking to each other, but no, they're not. They're playing it like they're two storytellers.
Yeah.
And it works well. Like I have to say, like, as much as I'm often like, oh, a cover version got really famous, like I'm not mad at Luke Combs. I think he did a good no, job. And I think she's happy for him and probably happy to get a revival in the sense that now right. Gen Z people know this song, you know?
And like the song has a fair amount of grit to it. And while I think Tracy Chapman's voice
take
has
a shot, everybody.
Oh, but the oh gosh, imagine. Yeah. But this is grit in a different. What's another word I can use for grit? Like graveliness?
His, oh, you mean literal grit
like
to the
literal
voice?
In his voice.
Yeah, gravelly, a rasp. Yeah, gravelly. Yeah,
he has like a graveliness to his voice that Tracy Chapman doesn't as much. So it adds a little bit of vocal tension to the song when the lyrics add tension for me too.
Right.
And he like can almost get that note, you know, the high note.
Right.
And he's like reaching for it. And I love that like upward mobility reach that's mirrored in his voice. I'm reading too much into it, but that's my nature.
Do you like his version better?
No.
Okay. Yeah.
I like it a
Same.
Lot.
Same.
I
think
it
it's good, though.
I don't think... I mean, it's close, though, for me. It really
well,
is.
It's kind of the same.
It's, yeah.
It's kind of the same, right? So I'm sure there are people listening to this that hate it because of that.
Yeah.
Like some of you, even folks that maybe aren't into dance music go, oh, well, the Top Talk Swedish House one, at least they took a... Like, this is a little bit like he's doing a concert... And he does, just for fun, a cover of Fast Car. And he just plays it exactly right.
Right.
Like, my ska band will, like, play our set and we'll just throw in, like, a Real Big Fish song for fun. And we don't do, like, a reinter. We just play the song.
Yeah.
Because it's easier to learn that way. We just play it, right? Yeah. Or we'll do, you know, a cover. And sometimes you just do a straightforward cover because
so
it's fun.
So maybe
right?
people could argue that the Luke Combs version lacks artistry.
You could, yeah, that it's less original. Mm-hmm. It's just a well-performed cover of hers. And...
That's
so
good. That's
for some people,
me.
Maybe they hate that. For some yeah. people, that makes them like it because they go, well, it basically is Tracy Chapman sung by a different person.
And for some people, it might feel so nostalgic that they like it even more because it's nostalgia, right. but like modernized with this Luke Combs version.
But hopefully people go back and listen to this record, though, and not just Luke Combs version. Although she still, you know, gets.
I think she's OK. She's probably.
I hope. Yeah. Yeah.
I think
so.
She's like, oh, I want them to listen to yeah. my version.
So, OK. We just had verse 5,
mm-hmm.
which is sort of things are tough, but they'll get better, which kind of mixes the two vibes. It's kind of optimistic, but also realistic. But then we go right back into the chorus.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember when we were driving in your car? And so we've ended that chapter. Like chapter 2 is a short chapter, which is like...
It's not working out. We're trying to get it to
but
work.
But we're trying. We're still yeah. trying. There's no... We're not stuck in this cage. We're
and
still trying.
And she's, like, pleading for hope. Like, remember, let's go back to being hopeful. Right. Let's go back to it. We can get there.
And it's just really interesting that it doesn't have a structure where we get a couple more verses.
Yeah.
The story is not elaborated on. We go right to the nostalgia, sad, do you remember it being happy chorus? This is going to be a cycle.
Right.
Every little inch, we're thrown back a little bit, right?
Yeah, you can, like, start feeling, like... The vortex pulling them down, you know?
Yeah. That's a positive way to look at it, that's for sure. Okay, so verse 6. This is the last full-length verse.
You got a fast car. I got a job that pays all our bills. Instead of drinking late at the bar, some more your friends than you do your kids. I'd always hope for better. Thought maybe together you and me find it. I got no plans, I ain't going nowhere. So take your fast car and keep on driving.
Yeah, this is the sad part for me because she's yeah. saying like, I'm fine, you're broken, I'm fine, and I'm going to be fine without yeah. you. And I think that that's really powerful. And I think it's
take your fast car and keep on. The fast on car driving. Is the thing you remember as a part of positive memory. But actually, please just keep driving, dude.
Yeah.
Get out, you know.
It's so funny. I always took it so literally. Like, here are your car keys. Go. Right. Get in your car and drive away.
Yeah.
But now I'm seeing that. Yeah, it is a reference to this. Like, take your good memories. Take like all the things that we had in the past and just get out.
Is it over now? Because this is still spoken like it's present tense. But yeah. The chorus that we have, we have a chorus immediately again. The third chorus happens here, not another verse, which is still remembering. It's still, so this over at this point?
Yeah, I think she's getting to she's getting fed up and she's prioritizing herself and her kids and realizing that having him not around is going to be better off and less of a burden than having him around. And that's a sad realization, but also a really empowering one, I think, for a lot of women that are, she's trying to break the cycle. She's trying to not do what her mom did and what her dad did. And she's realizing that with him, she's going to be still trapped in that cycle. So she needs to like get him out of the picture so she can move on.
So going back to what you brought up, the locus of control, where are we at with this?
She's still maintaining this internal locus of control that she can change. And he's just getting swept up in all these external things and not showing an intrinsic motivation towards change. And she's saying, like, I'm going to make changes that are going to positively impact myself and my family's life. And if you're not going to be with me in those changes, you can just drive away. You can get driving.
Has she escaped the cycle of poverty?
Not yet, but she's trying. She's like clawing at it. Yeah. That's why this song's so emotional for me. Like, I'm getting like emotionally even talking about it because she's trying so hard.
You're much better at speaking clearly when I can see it in your eyes.
I know. I'm like,
but I'm all choked. When I do it, I lose my I start wobbling.
I can maintain.
They've heard it. No. Good job. You should sing sad songs on stage because that's the hard thing. So our last verse is sort of an outro. So we have this long chapter one and then a short chapter two, short chapter three, where things sort of accelerate negatively, sort of. And our last chorus is our last glimpse of this kind of remember the positivity.
Mm.
But we have, I think this last verse is parallel to our fourth verse. The fourth verse, remember, was the, we got to make a decision. Are we going to do this or not? Here's verse 7.
You got a fast car. Is it fast enough so you can fly away? You got to make a decision. Leave tonight or live and die this way.
Is she talking to him, I think him in this story, or is she talking to herself?
I think she's talking to herself.
Leave tonight or live and die this way.
Yeah, like leave him tonight or like get trapped in this cycle again.
Yeah. And
now I'm crying. Now it's like really happening.
Yeah, I'll talk okay. Then. Unless you want to amplify that.
No, thank you.
How does this end?
It just like stops.
It just stops. This riff is kind of bright and cheery, but a little bit like plaintive, kind of introspective sounding. And it just sort of ends in the middle.
Yeah,
but it ends on a nice stable chord.
And like the repetition of it, we're looking for a resolution because we've been primed hearing this riff throughout the whole song that it's going to resolve. It's going to close and it doesn't. And I think that's really beautiful because there is no resolution. And like we think that we're going to get to an end point of our challenges and we never do. It just kind of keeps going. And that's like why life's awesome, because it keeps getting challenging. I have to stop talking.
Yeah.
It's bad.
I feel like this podcast is like therapy.
What's happening to me?
Literally our last episode, I'm like trying. And then like you're doing, are we just, is it done? Are we going to be talking about we're going to be talking about some bubblegum pop next season, and we're going to just be bawling or
I'm
whatever.
I'm like leaking this like salty discharge from my eyes and it's not
someone great. Get a plumber.
You're going to malfunction over here.
You should we change the subject or
no,
are we hitting,
it's okay. Like, I'm done now.
Because my last thing is to talk about other songs that do
that's
verse
great.
Structures. But like,
let's do that.
Just wrapping up to emphasize a point for the 80th time. Like I started from the frame of like, God, this is kind of boring. There's four verses, but I think that emotion that you're experiencing is kind of unlocked to a certain extent by how long that chorus takes to get there and how many times we hear the verses. It forces us, if you're someone who listens to lyrics, which I'm really happy.
Yes.
After I heard the record and I heard some of literally that song Behind the Wall has no instruments. I have to listen to the words.
Beautiful.
Right.
Beautiful.
And it forced me the next time I heard this song to go, maybe I should actually listen more carefully. Hearing that kind of turn in the story in that first cycle of the four verses, and then the way it's chopped up with these smaller pieces later, lets us really open ourselves to the questions this is asking. Does she get out? Like, should we be happy for her, sad for her? Like, it's very complicated.
And you get invested in the character in the exposition of all the choruses on the front end of the song, that when she gets to the chorus and like the emotional apex of the song, and you're on her side. Like, you're not saying like, oh, you should work it out with him. Maybe you can change him.
Oh, you left your dad. Go back.
Right?
No, no.
Like,
it's
just like your mom left her.
Right.
Yeah, but she's doing it for the same reasons. And I think that's a really interesting piece that doesn't, when we talk about like cycles here and generational cycles of this control, locus of control, like her mom left her dad for the same reason that she's leaving her partner.
Right? Yeah.
But instead of the mom just left and left the house behind, she's telling him to get out of the house. She's like kind of breaking that cycle. She's telling him to go. And I think that that's positive.
I think so. I think she's telling him to go, but I don't know. Especially folk music will sometimes do this thing where there's this like long series of verses, right? So I've got some examples, not all folk related, but where we can see lots of verses piling up in a way that enriches the story and makes it more like has a chapter storytelling. Because fundamentally, why is this song great? Because it's good storytelling.
I love storytelling in music. If you play Bob Dylan's Don't Think Twice, It's All Right, I'm going to lose it. Is that one of your songs?
I'm not playing that Bob Dylan song.
That's the one. That'll get me. That should have been on my songs that make me cry.
I'll start with the Bob Dylan, though.
Okay.
So because this does come from a lot of times, the folk tradition will do this. What I'm not pulling from is the really abstract songs. So like American Pie by Don McLean, or Hallelujah by Leonard Cohen, which is like 40 verses in the original verse, but really it's all just abstract ways he's talking about sex, right? Like in American Pie, yes, he's inspired by the plane crash and all that, but it's kind of a surrealistic journey. I'm looking at ones that are actually really following a story.
Like true ballads.
A ballad in the true sense of it. Not a sad, slow love song, but a story.
This
is Bob Dylan, 1975, Hurricane.
Okay.
Which... not Don't Think Twice, It's All Right.
Thank goodness.
Isn't that?
I can't handle it.
That's a little more abstract lyrically, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So this one has some weird stuff, but it is also telling a story about Reuben Hurricane Carter, who's, you know, falsely accused of murder. 17 verses.
Oh my gosh.
But it jumps around to different characters at different points. So each one of these verses plays a very specific role in the emotional story in the same way, or in a similar way, rather, to what Tracy Chapman is doing. There's only three choruses in this entire song, and the first one happens after the first verse.
I'm looking at the lyrics now, and I'm like, where? It's a while down there.
Well, no, the first one happens after the first verse, and then we have a long way before the second. So here's a snippet.
Pistol shots ring out in a barroom night. Enter Betty Valentine from the upper hall. A bartender in a pool of blood cries out, my God, they've killed them all. Here comes...
Right, so that's one of the verses as a sample. It's unending at parts, and then we hit that chorus, and each one of these is introducing a new kind of complex aspect of this narrative. So a couple other examples going in different directions. 1983. This song has three super long verses. The first one is sort of a framing story, and the second and third are arguments with his parents.
Okay.
This is institutionalized by suicidal tendencies.
Oh,
if you know it.
No, I don't. I'm sorry. This is
really?
Not a shock to our listeners.
This is not folk music.
No.
It's like from the perspective of a teenager who's going to be institutionalized by his family, and each one is sort of a different frame in the argument, the debate he's having with them, and it culminates in the really intense chorus. So here's a sample.
It just doesn't work out the way I want it to, and I get real frustrated. They're like, I try hard to do it, and I like take my time, but it just doesn't work out the way I want it to. It's like I concentrate on real hard, but it just doesn't work
mic, you know, we've been noticing you've been having a lot of problems lately, you know?
So it's
I love that, though.
It's not a bunch of verses. It's super long verses.
Yeah.
Right.
And it seems like really cathartic.
You know, I've never heard that. I'm not crazy. Institution.
Okay. Is that the song?
They put me in an institution.
I know that.
It speeds up to
the
a chorus, crazy,
I guess, but
crossover thrash chorus, right?
Do you know that the lead singer of this band, like the band's makeup has changed so much over time, but he's just the only consistent person in the band this whole time?
I didn't know that, but that does
like a really Paramore.
It's a Paramore.
Like Paramore thing.
Thing, yeah.
I just Googled
something
that.
Something in common. All right.
So listen, I went from never even knowing nothing to knowing a lot.
To knowing a lot. Yeah, that's what
the internet will do.
Okay. 1975 also, like Hurricane. Lion Eyes by the Eagles.
Oh, yeah.
So this one waffles back and forth. Each verse is either a description of what's happening or a rationale. Some of them seem to change who the bad guy is. Like there's certain verses that give us sympathy for the woman who's out having the affair.
Mm-hmm.
And then because her husband's kind of lame. But then you go to some verses where it's like, wait, that sucks for the guy too, right? So here's a sample of that, punctuated by these choruses that are always simple and straightforward and the same.
City girls just seem to find out early how to open doors with just a smile. A rich old man, and she won't have to worry. She'll dress up.
They're really painting a picture, and all the songs that you're pulling do that. It's not a veiled narrative. It's a straightforward narrative. Like we're storytelling here, and I obviously respond really well.
And the idea is these songs, and I'm only playing small snippets, but each mm-hmm. verse is giving you a different part of the story,
yeah.
specifically, and not just that, a different emotional beat in the story, as opposed to just more detail. I will say though, this one, I do think this is a beautiful song. Around like verse 8, I'm like, okay,
let's
I don't need another verse, man. Let's get back to it. Because the verses are long also,
yeah.
right? Each one, that was one verse. And then there's going to be, I think, two more before we get a chorus. Last example, Alu Black, you know,
Alu Black. I like them.
2010, you know, so his most famous moment in pop culture probably is the vocalist in Wake Me Up by Avicii, right?
Yes.
But this tune, I Need a Dollar, four verses, so a little more than average, but not as long as some of these other ones. The first one sort of frames, and then each one is a different specific, and he's talking about being essentially like destitute, and
yeah.
like each ones are different parts of the story, and then the fourth verse really is emphasizing sort of the emotional reality, and it's really effective.
Yeah.
Again, not as much in the folk tradition, but similar kind of American roots music.
Bad times are coming and I reap what I done sowed.
Hey, hey.
Well, let me tell you something. All that glitters ain't gold.
Hey, hey.
It's been a long old troublesome road. And I'm looking for somebody come and help me carry this load.
Yeah, I love the song. And he talks about, you know, having friends to help him out and trying to find jobs. And then how kind of life gets him down. And he's like, get a lot of toxicity in his life that he's trying to avoid. This one doesn't seem as much like lyrically driving a narrative, but like the repetitive nature of it. And like the bits that are obviously like repeated throughout the song, like bring you back to that storytelling, bring you back to that moment of like, who is this person?
Yeah.
And I'm into Alu Black. Cool. He's so handsome.
Yeah.
You know,
you can hear it in the,
you can
the,
hear it.
In the melody. Yeah. all right. Is there a more upbeat way we can end on this? That's all I got, but...
Upbeat. Yeah, I mean, I believe that people can overcome their circumstances. I think that's generally an upbeat mentality. It's sad to me when people feel like they can't escape the vortex of life, like, pulling them down, but also that's a kind of a privileged position to come from. Like,
yeah.
I live a blessed life. Live a blessed life.
You're saying don't do learned helplessness.
Don't
everybody.
Do it.
Avoid it. Like say no to learned helplessness.
Just say no to learned helplessness.
The notably successful foolproof dare
yeah.
method from the 1980s.
Yeah, right. The war on
apply
drugs.
For all your psychological
drugs
principles.
One. The thing that too, and I will say like Seligman himself, when you think of his theories of learned helplessness, and I know that we would focus more on locus of control, but he did like come later in his career founded the whole, really the school of positive psychology and switched his whole thing around to be like learned optimism. Like we can promote the other side of it. We can promote like no matter what happens, you can still overcome. And let's lean into that internal locus of control that you have control over your own destiny. And I think that that's an uplifting thing. It's not like funny, but it could be.
Any psychology concept is funny if you just imagine
the rats.
The rats, yeah.
Like the experiments of the rats.
Yeah, that, I'm sure it was hilarious to watch like these rats escape the cage or whatever they have
like
them in.
A fast car, and they put their arms around each other.
Dude, do you remember the mouse and the motorcycle?
No. What are you talking about?
Just look up the mouse and the motorcycle. It was a movie from when we were little kids, or maybe before.
Are you talking about Feifel?
No, An American Tale. That's
that'll make you cry.
Movie.
We weren't allowed to watch it as a kid.
Little kid. Why? Because it had Russians in it?
Yeah, no.
Nevermind the Music is hosted by Nicole Batcher and me, Mark Poppany. I also produce. Please leave us a rating and a review, and don't forget to follow. We're Never Music Pod on social media, and you can also send us an email at nevermusicpod@gmail.com. Nevermind the Music is part of the Lorehounds Network. Join the conversation by going to thelorehounds.com and hop on our Discord server. Thanks for listening.